Today is November 16, 2016. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I am here talking with Lauren Rowan on behalf of the Mill Valley Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society. Lauren?
I thought it was Hysterical Society.
At times. But we're historically hysterical.
That is a good way to put it.
Lauren, I'm about to introduce you, but my notes, there's too many things here. I'd like you to help me in describing who you are in our community, what you do, and all the many faces and places and things that you go and do and be. How about that?
All right. Do you want the long version or the short version?
Let's just jump in and...
All right. Well, I'm a musician, and that includes I'm a multi-instrumentalist. I play guitar, mandolin, bass, piano. Anything I can pick up, I'll try to play. Bamboo flute. At least dabble with it. Sticks. Pick up sticks. Rhythm. I'm a singer. I'm a writer of not only songs, but TV music, instrumental music. That I've always been interested in world music, which means music from international places, Jamaica, the Caribbean, Cuba, and Europe, Italy, France, Japan. I just love all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a little bit of acting, but I love performing, and that's another form of acting, I think. So that's one of my favorite things, to perform live, and I have a couple of different avenues for doing that. And I've always sort of kept, in my world of growing up with the music business, found that I like to have different things going on. So I've got several irons in the fire always going. And so if one cools down, there's another one that's heating up. So it keeps me busy and I'm fulfilled, really, in my search for being able to find an outlet for creativity.
Mm-hmm. Well, around here, and as I know you as a musician, primarily with your band, I know you work with Gary Yost as well, filmmaker.
Yeah.
But let's, you know, obviously you've got a lot of interests and you've got a lot of abilities. Let's go back, though, to get some context to the beginning. I mean, you've come from somewhere and some people, and I'd be interested to know a little bit about your family history and those early influences that sparked all this creativity.
Well, I grew up in a town called Wayland, Massachusetts. Was born in Boston. My parents were both from New England. Lived in this suburban town called Wayland, which is kind of like a Mill Valley. Now that it's as Mill Valley has grown into the 2000s, the 21st century, things have changed, you know, from the simplicity of what it was, which I found similar to, we'll get into that though, with Mill Valley. But Wayland was beautiful countryside, really, with a local farmer that was a friend of ours. We had some back land that he would farm and plow and till. So we grew up with this really nice in the country feeling. And parents were musically appreciative. They used to love to their generation of music, which came from like Camelot, and they grew up in the 20s and 30s, 40s, but they had an appreciation for music. They weren't musicians in particular, but I know my dad sang. My mother had learned how to play piano. And so there was definitely, and I have two other brothers, so I'm the youngest of three. And music was happening when I was born from my older brother, Peter. I guess he started it because he was the oldest, and he got exposed around the Elvis Presley era. So when I was born, my middle brother Chris, we've got Elvis, and we have the Everly Brothers, and we have the late 50s music. I was born in 52. So I grew up with a lot of musical influence and started playing guitar, ukulele. I started with a tennis racket, you know, imitating. That was kind of the idea. Then I got a ukulele. I remember my brother Peter, I had put the guitar in backwards. It's only a few people play the guitar backwards, like Jimi Hendrix, Paul McCartney.
Are you left-handed?
Well, I guess I was kind of ambidextrous, I think. But my brother said, why don't you try it this way? And he put it the other way, and I went with that. But I started playing it backwards. And I remember that moment, he said, play it this way. I went, oh, okay. And it's sort of set up to play this way. So I don't still know how these guys play left-handed, be that as it may. So I grew up, music was just an early part. I was inspired by music from a very early age. Started playing mandolin.
How old?
Started learning, I was probably 8, 9 years old. When I started to actually get into like picking up an instrument and playing it, and my parents were very open about letting me do that. They didn't restrict us at all, but they always thought, well, you're not going to be a musician. It didn't even come to that at that point in our age group. Maybe more for Peter being the oldest. You have to think of it, and I think it talking about the generation of growing up in the late 50s and then the early 60s, and then you have the Beatles, and especially for my brother Chris and me, that was a turning point from the early music I was getting exposed to was, well, it was the Everly Brothers, that kind of great harmony. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of bluegrass country music going on that was coming from West Virginia and was getting played up in Cambridge. And my brother Pete was being the older brother. He's 10 years older. Would hear that, and he'd bring home records like that. I mean, we'd have, before that, it was Buddy Holly, blues, Muddy Waters. There'd be these records in the living room, and I would go put them on when I was by myself in the house and just get, wow, this is so cool.
You know, I have to say, it's great when you're describing the age of your brothers by the music that they were listening to.
Yeah, well, it's a big reason. It's a big influence. And it was great because my brothers and I were still very close. And we just had a bond together through the music. We all play music.
And your parents didn't?
My dad was a singer. Glee
Club
singer.
What's your dad's name?
Paul Donovan. Paul Donovan Hamilton Rowan.
And your mother?
Elizabeth Wallace Richards. That's her maiden name. So she's Elizabeth Wallace Richards.
Right? Irish, yes.
Mom was Scottish, English, and Dad was more Irish.
And in the Boston area?
Yeah.
So had your family been there for a while?
Oh, yeah. So let me think about that. Oh, yeah. My dad's side, his father brought the grandfather, my dad's grandfather, his father, my dad's father brought his father, grandfather, over from Ireland, and my grandfather, my dad's father, had worked for a farmer, for a landowner in Wayland. And I don't have enough family people left that can tell me more about. I wish I did dig more deeper into that, but my grandfather was a builder, so he built some of the houses on the street we grew up in. My dad grew up on that street. So there was some nice parcel of land there that was later got bought by the town as protected. They didn't want it to be built on. And we didn't have a lot. There was one big crown jewel on top of this beautiful meadow that you walk up to. A lot of swamp land. So it was always kind of, well, I don't know if you ever build up there. But it used to be farmed. But it was great because there's a lot of wide open spaces. And, for conservation, they bought it. It's now called Rowan Hill, which is nice. For perpetuity, it'll be a place that you can just wander. It's not like a big park where lots of people go, but if you know about it, it's just beautiful. Several acres, maybe 10 acres worth of, you can probably walk on 2 or 3 of the acres. There's a nice trails, but you're surrounded in this beautiful preserved, swampland. And some drier area up on top. It's beautiful. Every time I go back east and play tour, I always go visit and walk around.
Go to Rowan Park?
Yeah, Rowan Hill.
Rowan Hill. Have you ever written a song about it?
God, I was inspired by it for years. It's inspired other songs. I'd sit up there and play or camp out there, and it was pretty neat.
So you're raised there.
So dad's family grew up there. My dad grew up there, and his mother and father. I didn't get to know them when I was little. They'd already, by the time I was born, they'd already passed. Peter remembers a little bit of them, being 10 years older. And let's see. So that was, we grew up on the house that my dad had actually lived in, and his father had helped build, or had built. He built several on the street, Draper Road. And it had a great, it was just a great small town. And we had a local farmer that was, we'd go work for him as we got older, and that was always a thrill. It was the classic get up at 6 in the morning, if you got lucky to be asked to work with him, you go, yeah, show up at 6. You'd have the Kellogg's breakfast. You'd have the cereal. You'd have the great eggs from his, from the farm, you know. And you were like, oh, I am living now. This is so exciting. Go out and I think my first job was weeding the cornfields. Getting paid, what, a quarter maybe? I don't know. But it was like, I guess that's what I'm doing. All right. But you go over there. You know, he had a bunch of kids, different age groups. But that was always fun. Growing up on the farm. Yeah, that was inspiring, though. As a songwriter, I've drawn from a lot of that. And I'll play you something in a bit that combines a friend from that grew up here in Mill Valley. And we, not to jump to that, but there's a lot of influence from, I've always been influenced from where I grew up. And nature, too. Mm-hmm. So it's very inspiring.
So when did you...
Mom's family was English. She came from a little bit more sophisticated, aristocratic, so to speak. A little more privileged than my dad. Was more of the country gentleman kind of thing. And I think he was playing polo when he met her. And they hit it off. And it was... The next rest is history. But... My mother had some great uncle that was our great uncle. It was her uncle, her mother's brother. He used to throw a family party every September, the beginning of September, and he traveled the world. He had inherited the business of running the Fitchburg Paper Company in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, which is an older industrial. Back when it was really kind of happening more. I don't think it's still running the same way. But like the textile business that my dad worked in, that was all it was very happening back then. Mm-hmm. And I think it's changed with the times, of course. But Uncle George was George Wallace. You can read about him if you look up Fitchburg. He was a philanthropist. He inherited the Fitchburg Paper Company from his dad. Carried it on, but also he was a musician. So he took to us. He thought we were like the greatest. That he totally endorsed, wanted us always to bring our instruments. He always called them banjos. He played banjos because we had guitars. He'd go, boys, did you bring your banjos? And we would always laugh. And go, he thinks we're playing banjos. But he was great. He had magic tricks from FOA Schwartz, like really high-end magic tricks for the time. And he would put on little shows. It would be like he would bring the whole, my mother's side of the family, her aunts and her cousins. We'd get to a lobster clam bake at this beautiful, he had this sort of Frank Lloyd Wright kind of design modern house, which was really cool. When you walk in, you're like, oh, this is so different. But he would have the family party and we'd always say, and now the Rowan boys are going to sing for you.
Say it in the accent again.
Uncle George, boys, did you bring your banjos? And now the Rowan boys are going to play for us. He kind of looked like a cousin of Colonel Sanders. But I mean, he was like the good-looking Colonel. But he had the white mustache. He was very debonair, and he was just a very giving and loving person.
Do you think you may have received some of that DNA that inspired him to perform and put on events?
Yeah, I do. I think it runs in. Oh, my mother's grandmother, my great grandmother, my mother's grandmother, was an opera singer. Oh. So it's in New York City. I mean, I read that about 15 years ago, and my mother kept a beautiful family album that we still have, and it's like the Akashic records of our life. It's pretty neat. And there's like an obituary. I went, oh my God, I never realized that. I probably read it before, but never. You know, didn't retain it, but as I go back and listen again, I went, wow. So yeah, there's some definitely, yeah, it came through us. And we're like the total extra version of it. Meaning that music is our main driving thing that we do as our brothers, and on my own too.
So did you start a band with your brothers when you were
little? Oh yeah. Yeah, Chris and I had a little bluegrass band. But Chris is in the middle, so I'm just saying that the age difference gives you a little different. You know, when you're younger, you're not hanging out with the seniors when you're a freshman. Well, maybe by then you are in high school, but it's a big difference until you get into your, I guess, 20s, then 30s. By then, you know, what's now it's like 15 years difference. I have friends 15 years older and 15 years younger. You know what I mean? And you're like, Oh, it's in time to change that way, I think. Mm-hmm. Our generation...
all evens out later.
Yeah, well, I think growing up in the 60s was an amazing time to experience kind of the tail end of before things got so technologically advanced with the internet and all that, which is great progress, I'm sure. But back then, it was a whole different scene, and there was such a social thing going on that we grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
That I think was, you won't see that again quite in our lifetime, I don't think. I think it was a great time because the music was just incredible, and the transformation of social gatherings of people. Music has become such a big thing for, and especially the older generation, the baby boomers. You know, there's a world out there of music appreciation that's going on. Some Grateful Dead have it, huge following that still gives an opportunity for people and other groups that are lasting longer. The Rolling Stones, it's so cool to see. It's not like, oh, that was just a little teeny bopper thing and that's over. Even for myself, that I'm still playing music, I may not be at the height of a huge superstar act, but I still make music as my career. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited about it.
So when did you leave Boston?
Left Boston. Story goes, Chris and I were playing separately, but this particular guy, David Grisman, who he was in Massachusetts, he had played with Peter in a group called Earth Opera. And they had split up, but David was starting his own production company, which just meant he wanted to produce some talent. And my brother Chris thought, oh, I'll go check out David. You know, when you're
For those that are listening and don't know, David Grisman is a very famous musician.
Yeah, well, he was our producer. Mm-hmm. He said to Chris and I, when we were, I went to him with my own piano player friend, Bill Elliott, that we grew up with. And we said, we want to play for you, because we thought, we were all looking to get a record deal. Of course, I was like 16 and Chris was 20. Chris was already... David had sort of put him on a little salary, and so there was this little, well, maybe this guy can help us get there. When I went to play for David, he said, after he heard me and my piano player, he said, have you ever thought of playing with your brother? And I was like, well, yeah, we grew up together. We played on and off. But, you know, as I said, the difference in age groups, like when I was 16, I was still in school. Chris was going off to England to go try to meet the Beatles for their Apple Records. And he did get close, but he didn't get a record deal with it. But, which doesn't matter because we got one later. So David said, why don't you guys, you ever thought of playing together? We said, sure. He said, we think you guys went together. He and his agent that worked with him.
Said, David said this.
David, yeah. He said, if you, you might get a better chance at getting into the music business if you join forces as an act. And we were like, all right, let's try it. So that's how we started. And then we decided we were either going to go to England, because that was sort of a happening thing. Groups like Jimi Hendrix, America, you're hearing about people going over to England and getting discovered, because England was really at the top of the happening scene with the Beatles, and then just so many groups coming out of Eric Clapton,
Eric Burden and the Animals,
you just name it, that whole British invasion. Mm-hmm. So that in Carnaby Street, it was like, oh, maybe we should go there. But then David had several years before had already played with a guy named Jerry Garcia in a bluegrass context. And they'd remained friends over the years, and somehow, I guess it came up for David to play on their record American Beauty, on a song called Friend of the Devil. So he did some session work. He got flown out to California, and he came back and he said, I know where we should go. We should go to the West Coast. We should go to Marin County. My friend Jerry Garcia lives out there, and there's a really cool scene of nurturing music.
And this is what year?
70. This was 69. And so by 1970, the fall of 1970, we did the Beverly Hillbillies thing. We got in the, we didn't have the oil, but we were going to look for the oil. We left and drove across country with our...
You and your brothers.
Say goodbye to Mom. Dad had already passed away just a few months before that, actually. Yeah, and we went out to seek our fame and fortune on the West Coast. As we got written up in the Town Crier back in Wayland, it's a local paper. They interviewed us after we had gotten a record deal when we came out here after about a year. But we went back, and the town said, oh, we got to interview you guys, because we were like, we got a lot of good press. We got signed by a huge music mogul, Clive Davis, to Columbia Records. But the town crier wrote, the Rowan Brothers, the weird, wacky world of California. Go to the weird, wacky world of California, the weird, rootless world of California. That was sort of the image you had from the East Coast. Uh-huh. You know, really growing up on the East Coast, we were this Eastern Seaboard, and it was a different lifestyle. I had no idea. I mean, when I heard about the West Coast music at the time, it wasn't really appealing to me. I did the Jefferson Airplane came through town. I remember sitting at this club, Paul's Mall, in Boston, and the Airplane was playing. They were kind of a little more pop than the Grateful Dead. I didn't really think they had a sound that it was appealing to me like the Beatles. We were so influenced by the British invasion and the kind of pop songs. That was that kind of thing we were writing, the jammy, and they weren't as polished, you know. Not to say they're not now, of course. It's totally different. Times change, and they've evolved into this, which is way nice to see things happen. Mm-hmm. But we were playing more like the Beatles music, but we thought, okay, let's go out. We're going to California. So we came out here, and we did meet Jerry Garcia on a personal level, and he was really enthusiastic about what we were doing and offered to play on some demos for us. So we sort of built about maybe within a year's time, we had a bunch of recordings with Marty Balin from the Jefferson Airplane. Was a big fan. He ended up recording a couple of my songs, and we're still friends to this day about that. And we got a record deal. We went down and met with J.B. Grisband's agent that became, like, they had their production team, and he was our manager, Richard Loren. He knew David Geffen down in L.A., which is another mogul, who was starting a company called Asylum Records. But Richard and David had worked in New York at the William Morris Talent Agency, and in the mailroom or something like that. And that's where David Geffen started, right? And then he went on, like, you know, you get in the door, and if you got aspirations and you got a drive, it looks like you can climb your way up.
Now, you're how old again here?
64. Oh, when I was doing that? Oh, yeah. I was 18.
You're 18 years old, 19. And you're getting a major record deal.
Yeah. Well, I got offered one when I was 15, while my brother Peter was recording with David Grisman. Just to fill you in on this funny part of the story, David Grisman and Peter were at Earth Opera. I had my own little band with a good friend from high school and her sister. She played cello, and my friend Batty McNeil at the time, she was a singer. And her boyfriend Carl was a friend of mine. He played guitar. So I started a little band around my original music, and I made a little cassette. Back then it was a cassette, or it wasn't even a cassette. It was a tape. That's right. We didn't have cassettes yet. I played it for Peter while he was working in his band, Earth Opera, and he and David shared a place, and Peter was like, that sounds great. So he played it for his producer, and then all of a sudden, within one thing led to another, I got called. They wanted to sign me to a record deal. And it was kind of like at 15, and because I had these friends, I was feeling, this is a classic example of, you know, your loyalty, right? And they didn't want to sign the whole band. They just wanted to sign me and have a producer come in. And I thought at the time, wow, I don't know if I should do that. And my brother Peter said, hey, well, you know, you still got plenty of time. It'll change your life. You know, you might want to just keep going with what you're doing. You know, we'll probably get there anyway. So that was kind of my best advice. My dad and mom flew down with me, and they were like, oh, they want to sign you. So they got, it was like we got picked up in a limousine, taken to a great lunch. You know, here's the president, Jack Holtzman of Elektra Records. They had signed the Doors. They already had the Doors.
And this is for when you're 15 years old?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, wow, I'm getting a record deal. And we went in and cut like 20 songs, of which I have preserved on CD in the last year. My friend Maddie had recorded it. These demos, I still have those. They're probably like the kind of demos you'd make. They're acetates, which means you can only play them a few times, and they're just for quick listening, and then they're not the final record, so mm-hmm. They're like a heavy looking version of a record. Mm-hmm. But oh my god, so I have it on tape, her playing it off of her Victrola, or back we call it a Victrola, high fidelity record player, when she recorded it with a pretty good not like that, the Zoom, but a tape recorder with microphones. So it's actually coming from the speakers. It actually retains the integrity of the performance, but I have it, and my voice hadn't even changed. And I've got like 20 songs, and I was writing songs that I'm still, I listen to it, and I go, I gotta rework that one. Some of them I have, but it used to come to you. I think this happens a lot when you see these young kids today. It doesn't surprise me at all, because I think when you're young, and if you get inspired, by the time you're 10, 11, 12, or even younger, but 12, 13, you get in the teenage, you're on fire with inspiration. If that's what you love to do, it'll come through you. Because you're open. I think it's partly because you're open and you haven't had any doors shut on you. I mean, I don't know if it's that much, even that heavy. It's not even about doors shutting on you, but, you know, you're kind of free. If you're, I was lucky to have a nice upbringing of family. I wasn't poor, you know what I mean? I wasn't rich, but I wasn't poor. Mm-hmm. And I think that nurtured it too. But anyway, yeah, I was writing songs. My older brothers were writing songs. So to me, it was just, maybe I was trying to catch up.
So what was it like when you came here to be working?
Well, that was a difference. So we totally fell in love with, you know, I've lived in Marin County my whole life. I mean, my whole second life since I moved out here. I've never lived in the city. And not that I never had to, or it never happened that I wanted to more than live out here. The nature, okay, we first got out here, our minds were blown. We were like, oh my God, this is a totally different vibe. We had come out to visit Peter. He'd been in a band, Sea Train, after Earth Opera. Sea Train was a California band. So I had visited the year before, and he lived in Sausalito, and I just remember it was just such a different air, and the plants were different. From the East Coast, and the seasons are different. So when it came out in February here, it was like spring was starting already. And I remember the acacia trees. Oh my God, what are these? And the smells. I remember the smells of, I didn't know Mill Valley at that point. So when I came out, the next time we first lived in a place called Kenfield. And, you know, I had my dog with me that I'd grown up with. And my brother had his dog that he'd gotten. Oh no, he got his dog out here anyway. It was my dog, Boswell. He lived to be like 28 years old or 18 years old or something incredible. So he basically came with me, and he lived till I was 28. So it was like 17 years. I got him when I was 11. But so we started in Kenfield, and we started meeting people, and it was really exciting. It was so different than, well, I was so young too at 17. I hadn't seen much of the world.
But what about school?
Well, I got out of school. I graduated.
You graduated early.
Yeah, and I did really well in public school. Both my brothers went to private schools because my parents thought they needed that. And somehow, I never did really good. I wanted to go too because I kind of loved the. It was sort of this thing about private schools. It seemed so cool to be like, you know, achieve to that. And poor, I'm glad I didn't do it. What did I say?
You graduated at age.
So 17. I was doing really great in high school. So. You know, I tried to get in on those SAT. I did terrible on those. So the school, the private school, I don't really think Lauren's is at, you know. And I went, God, I do so great at the other school. Those tests, I hate those tests. The SATs are like, I don't know. You know, number two pencil. And like, you go to the school, Belmont Hill, to go try to get into this thing. And so eventually it was like, you know, you ought to just stay at the high school. You do it so great there. I said, you know what, I will. The principal at the office there, I said, you know, I just want to, my last year in school, I said, when I was a senior, I said, I just want to take the basic courses because I'm going to go play music. I'm not going to go to college.
So you always
knew. I got out, like I had to go to school for like 3 hours a day. I didn't have to take extra courses. And the principal loved me. I mean, he endorsed what I was doing. He was like, Lauren, that's fantastic. Your grades are great. You just keep doing this. So yeah, I was like, wow. I felt like, I had support.
Mm-hmm. So you were at 17, you were over here?
With 17 going, I just turned 18 by the time I came here. I started working back, as I said, met Grisman, and Chris and I got together when I was still 17. But I was 18 when I came out here in the fall. You know, our dad had passed away in April of that year.
Kind of young.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, you know, ready to go look for fame and fortune and
play the music. No, but your dad was young, wasn't he?
He was 62.
That's younger than you are now.
Yeah, I think he had a little bit. Well, when he was younger, he had some polio in his arm. He and his sister-in-law, my father's brother's wife, they were at a cocktail party. This is what the story was. They don't know what happened, but they said the next day she was paralyzed and he had it in his arm, ended up in his finger, and he eventually got to work it, but it was kind of the muscle had toned. You know, he had to kept working on that. Could still play tennis with this arm, but his arm was a little not
his
gimpy,
left arm
but
was a little weaker.
Muscular effect, you know, from having polio. But my aunt was crippled for the rest of her life, paralyzed. They think it was from a cocktail party. They maybe got the virus. So that's wild. So, you know, we all got the virus thing. I mean, the vaccinations going. But what was I going to say? So
your dad...
Oh, dad died. Yeah, he died. I mean, I think he had a little high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think the diet, he definitely... he was more athletic when we were younger. I remember running with him like 20 years before that, or 15 years before that. He loved sports and stuff, but I think he had a hard time with the diet a bit. He wasn't super overweight, but they ate a more meat and potatoes kind of diet growing up. Mm-hmm. I mean, while we were growing up, a combination. But
must have been a little rough. Losing
oh,
your
it
dad.
Was. Yeah, that was the first big death. I mean, the other people had died. A neighbor, friend of theirs, had died, and we knew. Oh, scary, right? You think it's scared by the thought of death. And then, when he died, it was a huge, wow. So by the 6 months later, we were moving out here because we had an opportunity. And our mother was like, go for it, guys. I'll come out and visit. And she loved it, too. She'd come out and visit over the years. It was great. But so we moved out here, and we started meeting these great musicians like Jerry Garcia. And all of a sudden, my feelings about the Grateful Dead, it opened my mind up to like, well, this guy is so cool. And then I start, we start to go check out the Dead. They still weren't the kind of music that I was trying to achieve with David Grisman too producing us, because we really wanted to make a Sgt. Pepper. We wanted to make a Beatles quality record with George Martin's kind of integrity. That was kind of the bar that was set by the Beatles. And we were like, well, we got to try to do something on that level. Which everybody that got inspired by the Beatles, all these kids that so many people grew up going. When I heard the Beatles, I knew that's what I wanted to do. You know, I was already doing it, but it definitely went, oh, this is it. What a cool band. I mean, oh my God, I've never heard anything quite so much fun. And, you know, the songwriting level was, it was just really cool.
What's
so,
your favorite Beatles song?
Geez, I do them all, to tell you the truth. I've had three, four different Beatle bands over the years. And if anybody ever wants one, I always go, oh yeah, I got one. Oh, geez, one of my favorites. Well, I love John Lennon's stuff. In My Life, I love Paul McCartney's. I know they wrote them together, but you can tell that one guy wrote more of it. But Paul, I think, God, what are so many good ones. What would be the little, I think Eleanor Rigby's killer. Eleanor Rigby. I play that with one of my bands. We call it Eleanor Rigby Returns because we've changed it around from, we made it an instrumental. I have pedal steel guitar in that. Rattlebox is that band. Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but and cello and pedal steel and me on guitar. And we do a lot of instrumental, what you call mashups, which we take the song and put our own interludes into them. Mm-hmm. But you'll still go, oh, that's the... And then we'll play the main theme of what, like, Eleanor Rigby is. And people
the song
love
with the few walkabouts, eh?
What's that?
You play the main theme, but with walkabout.
Yeah, with walkabout, right.
So you're living here, you're working with David Grishman.
And we go down to meet Clive Davis, and then David Geffen heard it. Well, we went first to meet David Geffen, and he wanted to sign us. And then we get this call, this is a classic music business. Clive Davis is in town, and he and Geffen were like...
Clive Davis, for those that don't know who Clive Davis is.
Oh yeah, well he signed... Oh, well he's got, Whitney Houston was huge, but he did Janis Joplin, and he was president of Columbia Records at the time. Mm-hmm. He's gone on to... Now he's still out there as a huge mogul, and I occasionally will send him stuff and get a reply of, great to hear from you. Don't hear the hit. I have a few of those saved, yeah. Now I don't know how to reach him exactly, but he really liked us. So anyway, he heard we were getting, David Geffen wanted to sign us, and they were like competitive in the smallest sense of the largest sense of the word. I think David Geffen represented Laura Nyro, and he got her off of Columbia Records, and Clive was like, wait a minute, you know, I'm going to, you know. So he, Clive heard about us, and he had us come to the Beverly Hills Hotel. We were like, wow, walk in, and there's Georgie Jessel. And there's a guy like the call for Philip Morris, the bus bellboy, dressed like, call for Philip Morris. And there's Georgie Jessel. I'm like, that's Georgie Jessel. You know, how did I know that? It seemed like on Ed Sullivan show or something, you know, or some comedy show. And the Beverly Hills Hotel. Clive wants to meet you in the Polo Lounge. Sat in a room with a grand piano, not like that, but a grand piano. Just played him acoustically for about a half an hour. I'm signing you guys. We want to sign you. Well, David Geffen's already offered us $25,000. He said, I'll give you $50,000. And this wasn't us talking. This was our managers, but our manager and David Grisman, our team. And we even got them to, so we said, well, we want to use our guys. And they, you know, usually Columbia at the time, you had to use their engineers. It was stricter. So we had such a great opportunity there. So we got to do it all ourselves.
And what was your band called then?
Well, we started out, well, we were the Rowan Brothers by then. But before that, while we were working on it, we thought we'd call ourselves Holy Smoke. And then we had these two other brothers that played bass and drums. And I think what it was is our manager, David Grisman, and producer and manager, they had, I might as well tell you this, but Walter Reuther's daughter, Linda Reuther, you know who Walter Reuther was?
Yeah.
Associated Press, Walter Reuther was huge, I don't know what, he's total high-end business person, you know, probably like not a Steve Jobs, but, you know, somebody up there. Walter, if you look up Walter Reuther, huge business success. He had died, I think, in a plane crash or something, and his daughter, somehow, this is funny, David knew Linda Reuther's brother over in Berkeley or something, and somehow she became the investor. These guys were investing.
She was your Grisman benefactor.
Yeah, but we didn't know. We met her occasionally, but David and Richard Loren, David Grisman, they were our management. They made that deal. So they were like, you know, paying us a little bit of money, and we had enough to support our trip. And David would get an engineer that we had a commune going out in Stinson Beach, basically. We had several properties we rented. Converted one into a fantastic studio.
So you've gone from Kentfield, now you're living in Stinson Beach.
My friend went to Kentfield, then moved to a beautiful sort of country, old-time house out in Nevada, mm-hmm. near where the school is now, the college. Mm-hmm. It was great. It was a beautiful area. And then from there, we moved to Stinson Beach.
And to your compound.
Yeah, we got an incredible house right next to Ralph Gleason's house. Sacramento Patio. In Stinson, it's still out there, beautiful house. Yeah, I think it was going for $80,000 at one point. After we'd lived here a couple of years, we're going to sell it. If we'd had our brains, we would have bought it. But then again, we had a lot of group people. It doesn't matter, but we had a lot of group people. You know, a compound. That would have been like, how do we divide that?
Compound slash commune.
Yeah, we weren't really a commune, but we had our own. It was communal in a lot of ways that we were like all for one and one for all, and mm-hmm. probably naively doing that. Probably could have used a little more advice. As I was thinking about when I was younger at 15, my parents weren't like, yeah, look, we should do this. You could be, you know, I didn't have a business father, music business father that had any sense of, yeah. I mean, he was a textile salesman and he'd been a manager and stuff, but he ended up having a hard time with his business. Probably helped.
So you were sort of rudderless. You were young and in the business and musicians, but not businessmen.
Oh, yeah, totally. And we were like, yeah, we'll go. These guys are 10 years older than us, you know, figured they knew what they were doing. And it was just kind of like...
Sounds like a ride. You're on a ride.
Oh, totally a ride, yeah. So our whole thing was huge advance. We took our time in the studio. We didn't let our agent or producer, David, wouldn't let... don't let them come and hear the music till it's done. And eventually Clive Davis did come out. I kind of hear something. It'd been like probably 6-7 months. We were doing our Sgt. Pepper. We were taking like a year to make a record, which was silly kind of really. But it was like perfection. We were going for this perfection. And we just had such a ball doing it. We didn't think of it like, because we were just told, David had always said, you guys just do the music. we'll take care of the
business. So you were in the playground.
We were in the playground, and we were the guys. We were writing songs like left and right and having a blast with it. You know, Garcia would come and play pedal steel in the studio. It was very exciting.
How were your egos doing at that time?
Well, we thought we were on our way to huge success.
And, was there a lot of celebration?
We lived a great lifestyle. It was almost like before we finished the record, we were living this great lifestyle, living in Stinson Beach, creating any time of day, and working on it every day. It was fantastic. And we were really planning on how we were going to get a hit record, which was, well, we didn't get the hit record, so that sort of...
Do you have a song that you love from that record? And how did it do?
Loved a lot of them. I still have the records now. They're on CD now. Over the years, people have put them out, and I've collected them, so I have a bunch of those.
Do I know any of the songs?
I don't think so, no. Unless you knew us from back then. But it was very pop and a mixture of ballads and pop rock. Really cool production on it.
So you're the Rowan Brothers now. Let's move along.
Yeah.
And you're living in Stinson, and you're living in Marin.
Oh, yeah.
And you've got a society of friends. Like, who are the people you're hanging with besides
mainly our group. Mm-hmm. But other musicians we'd meet. Like, we might be friends with as Marty Balin or somebody like that. And
he was in Mill Valley, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you could walk by his old house anytime.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to tell you, that was when the airplane had played back in Boston. I was, as I was just going back for a
second.
See, I like the English groups, the American, you know, Beach Boys and stuff. But the West Coast music, I was kind of skeptical about it at 16. So the airplane came through and played Paul's Mall, which is this classic jazz club, but it was really every kind of music club. And the airplane, it was like 200 people. See, and they had just had their hit, or, you know. And
White Rabbit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were making their tour, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, my friend and I, Bill Elliott, we said, let's go hear them. So we went in. They had a little more of a pop sound than the Dead at the time. The Dead didn't really, they weren't trying for that sound. They were going a different thing, the jam band world, which is a great other thing. I remember Grace Slick looking out at me, and I was like looking like skeptical, like them, like.
She eventually said to me,
she went, "Don't you ever smile?" You know, hither Grace Slick. I was like, "Whoa." And then I laughed. I was like, "Oh yeah."
She
had checked me out. I was in the front row, like a little, you know, what is this shit?
But the people can't see because this is an audio recording. Is you've got a pinched look on your face,
yeah,
with a scowl, the skeptical scowl.
I was like,
scowl.
I don't know if I like this.
She said so pronounced that it stood out from all the other faces.
She finally looked at me and went, "Don't you ever smile?" I was like, you know, she was like, "Oh yeah, over there, at the end of the." Couch over there. It was a small club.
So she's like 20 feet away or less, 15.
And that was what blew my mind. I saw her years later out here. I told her that story. She laughed. I said, "You know, I heard you," and you looked at me. She went, "I did." I said, "Yeah." So it was great. We really got to meet. We got in some great doors. We ended up, without having a hit single, our agent manager, I think they made a poor decision on that. And I guess I did too, because I didn't stand up and say, "Why don't we do that?" We were all caught up in, like, we're going to have a hit record. We got Clive Davis, Columbia record behind us. And we had some pretty esoteric lyrics at the time on some of the songs. So the first one they picked, it's a great production. It has a great sound to it. It didn't hit. And this was a time when, like, Listen to the Music, the Doobie Brothers was out. That was more, you know, I don't know. I guess our thing just didn't attract a bunch of teeny boppers. So we got caught in this sort of like, well, our manager, Richard Loren, said, "Let's get Gloria, what's her name? Not Gloria Steinman, but there was this, she ran 17 magazine." So she was like, "We got to market the Rowan Brothers."
Oh, so they wanted to appeal to the teeny boppers.
Yeah. Well, we were still.
Because that's where the money is.
Yeah. I mean, in business sense, sure. Break in the market like any of the groups that actually start. I mean, that's the market that's buying the records. Like, you know, look today. And in the young art, I mean, that's just the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the good thing we have now is there is an audience from baby boomers that carries on from when we grew up. So, getting back to our...
So your big record flopped.
The big record, yeah, flopped.
Flopped.
And then we went on tour with the Grateful Dead.
So you opened...
Why? Because that was the connection we had through our management.
So you opened...
We passed on working with a pop agency. This sounds like confessions of a... sour...
Sour Grapes Confessions.
Maybe that's part of my book. I want to tap my foot right now. Sour Grapes Confessions. That's a great name. I'm going to write the book. Because everyone said, you should write your story. I said,
Sour Grapes
Confessions. Who wants to hear? I said, well, maybe they do. Sour Grapes Confessions. That's actually pretty good.
So we had to go to a different...
And then Clive Davis said, if you want to make another record with me, I want you to be produced by Mickey Most, who did Donovan.
Oh, wonderful.
And we were like, and he wants you to go to England. And we were like, okay, we'll do it. And then the weirdest thing happens. He gets fired. He had said we had to let go of David Grisman as a producer. So our commune kind of started.
So Clive stays, Dave goes.
What?
Clive Davis stays, but Dave Grisman goes.
Clive Davis in Columbia Records, he said, you got to get rid of, you can't use him again. Because we had spent so much money and didn't have the big hit. And he said, okay, you got to do it your way. If you want to do another record, I'm offering it to you. You go to England and work with this producer because this guy would... And it would have been so good for us. Because we would have gotten out of this kind of hippie lifestyle thing. And we would have worked with somebody... We were so malleable.
But I hear the binging of loyalty.
Yeah.
Ding.
Yeah.
Ding.
We were so loyal. You know, even any money we got, well, we just shared it. We got huge advances for the time, for publishing and stuff. You know, not, no sour grapes on that. That's more the bittersweet.
Sour grapes and bittersweet confessions.
Oh, that's even better. Sour grapes and bittersweet confessions. That's actually pretty cool. All the things that went wrong, but somehow through it all.
So you didn't go? You didn't go?
Oh, he gets fired. Columbia Records fires Clive Davis
because
of misappropriated funds. He used some funds to his son's bar mitzvah. I don't know. All we knew was like, oh, my our attorney, lawyer, music lawyer in L.A. goes, really sorry to tell you. He was talking like that, Stuart Gordon. Lauren, he was a big guy. He goes, Lauren Kress, I'm sorry to tell you, but Clive's been fired. So we were like, oh my God. Well, we'll sue them. I went, what? Because we had a contract for like two records. That whole company changed, and it was like we didn't know anybody in the company anymore. We'd gotten to know some people. Now it was like...
All this happening, you
and they didn't know who we were. They were like, you were Clive's babies. We're going to make sure, you know. So they were dropping lots of groups. They dropped... The New Writers were on there, too. The New Writers of Purple. They dropped a ton of groups that were anything to do with Clive that wasn't selling.
New Writers of the Purple Sage, for those that don't know. Very popular group at the time.
And we were friends with them, too. But it was not making records, but we got to know them. To this day, still know David Nelson really well. But he's a guitar player, one of the original members. So when that happened... Our other manager at the time, he said, you know, I think I want to bow out, but I want to turn you on to a guy I worked with that I think could help you better than I can. Because we started to see that the cracks in the foundation, it was like, uh-oh. And we didn't have any more money coming in, income. So it was more like Chris and I needed to find some other avenue. So we started to work with this. Our manager did do his best effort was to turn us on to... Kenny Loggins, and Loggins has been seen as manager.
Oh my gosh.
So we worked with Schiffman and Larson, which we used to call Schiffman and Shifty and Larceny in the music business. Confessions of sour grape. So they managed us for a while, and then at the same time, I always wanted Peter and Chris too, but me more. I was thinking, why don't we get Peter in the band? Pete, because he was
your older
free.
Brother.
Yeah, he had come out to California going, what are you guys doing? You know, he's like, he was watching our thing, and he was free from being with C-Train, who had moved back to New England while we had moved here. So we weren't on the same coast, but he had...
That's his band, C-Train.
Well, it was. He was part of it, and that was a California band. You can look them up if you... They were local, too. Marin kept a lot of Mill Valley. Peter was living in Mill Valley before he moved back to East, so... Anyway. So, what was I just saying?
Were saying that you are now renegotiating the way
things. Oh, so yeah, and I said, we got Peter to play. We said, Pete, why don't we join us? And he was like, yeah, this will be great. So the three of us started playing together. And then we eventually did get signed to David Geffen. We went back to David Geffen. We couldn't get signed by anybody. And then we said, why don't we call David Geffen? He already wanted to sign us before. So we called David Geffen. He said, yeah, I'll meet with you guys. And Lagos Messina at that time, we were kind of like, well, I don't think we can do anything for you guys, much more for you guys. So we were like, well, let's go on our own to talk to David Geffen. This is 45 years later, so we're already, when I was 17. So gaining a little bit of, business sense of how to take control of yourself. And we knew we had to do that. So we met with David Geffen, and he didn't want to even hear the music. He just said, the three of you? I said, yeah, you want to hear some sound? He goes, no, but you want to make hit records? We were like, yeah. So we ended up making three albums with Asylum, moderate success with that. No huge hit records, but that was the three of us. That lasted until about 78, 79. I'm still living in Mill Valley. We recorded down
now
in LA.
You were in Stinson, now you're in Mill Valley.
Well, no, but still at Stinson at the time. Mm-hmm. And started a band with Jimmy Dillon and Mark Stein. Mark and I knew each other because we lived on the same street, one of the calles, and we loved reggae. So Mark and I started playing together, and when Jimmy heard us playing a gig at the surf shop one night, and he came in and wanted to sit in, and he was living in Hawaii, I think, at the time, but he also had a place down in Stinson with his brother. And, we just had a great time jamming together. And then he came over to my house, and we jammed. It's like, wow, we had to hit it off great, and we still play great together like mm-hmm. that.
You played the other night at Gary Yost's presentation.
Yeah, we've got a backlog of material. So we started a band, and we were called the Average Beach Band. It was totally out of Stinson Beach, and it was over the Hill Bar and Grill. It just opened. It was like before, I think, the Blue Whale or the White Whale. And it was, one of these funky little Stinson Beach bar things. And now they've redone it in a way like, now you've got your big restaurants. But back there, it was like this cool new restaurant. And yeah, we had music there. And so we started our band.
What were the people that came to these shows? I mean, what's
20-year-olds. 20-year-olds from our age at the time. And that's who it was. And that's what the whole deal was. And we immediately, within a year or so, we changed the name to the Edge. We were a reggae rock band. We were playing at Uncle Charlie's over here at Corte Madera. Huey Lewis was just starting his thing. He'd already started. But
he was great. Clover then?
No, that was after Clover. Mm-hmm. We were great friends with him, too. A couple of the guys, Ozzy Allers in the band, knew Huey from college in Syracuse. Yeah, I mean, so anyway, it was a very cool. Uncle Charlie's was packed every night. It was a little icon of a microcosm of the moment. Where it's still today, I've run into people that remember my band or see me and go, "Aren't you?" We used to go to Uncle Charlie's. So it was a high point because it was packed on like a Wednesday night. It was just a really cool local Marin County scene. It was really nice. I still lived at Stinson, and used to love. Well, living in Stinson, I used to hike the mountain all the time. Kept exploring different trails. To this day, still like that. Mountain biking on it, that's a whole other story. But Mount Tam with Gary Yost and, it's like, spiritual place. Used to go up early in the morning at sunrise and sometimes just to see the sunrise. That was part of the fun of living at Stinson. It was just like outdoors in Marin County was just so beautiful. It made, you go to the city and you couldn't wait to get back to Marin County. You get over the Golden Gate Bridge. You're like, where is this place? The hills. You don't see that back east like that. Mm-hmm. It's a different job.
So you're playing there now.
So we had a huge following. We almost, this guy named Rick James, the black soul singer guy, uh-huh. He came out. He was recording a record down at the record plant here in Sausalito. That club was happening, Uncle Charlie. He came and heard us, and he was like, I can help you guys. So he turned us on to Jerry Weintraub's company, which managed his company, but there was an underling, guy's named Paul Gongawer. And I think of it, Paul Underwear, Paul Gongawer. Confessions of a soap opera. Anyway, Rick James became friends. We have a good picture of him, too.
What's one of his songs? Do you remember?
Super Freak. Freak. Yeah, he was totally the African-American hip, dreadlock, half-dreadlock kind of funk, super funk, But he loved our thing. He's like, you guys got the sound. This is the sound. You're
going to
be bigger than Huey Lewis, he said. We were like, yeah.
Well, give me a little of your sound. What's your sound?
Well, then let me lead on to that. So the, after the Edge, we played several years. We kept playing until even 5 years ago. We once in a while someone will hire us for a gig
as the Edge, and you all come back together again.
I always keep my ears open to somebody who says, "Do you guys still come?" Yeah. So that hasn't happened in a while. And, you know, I mean, I'm so busy doing other things, and so is the other guys too. Everybody has a life, and you know, as you've grown up, we're not like 20 years old riding around in a van.
You were then.
Yeah, although I still, I jokingly think I could do that if I wasn't in, married. If I wasn't married in such a happy marriage to Bernadette, my wife, I would be out there doing more. I would, you know, because it's like, what would keep you from, I mean, having a family life, even as it's two of us, it's just, it's a different, it's nice. That's a success. That's nice. And owning our own house, that's a success. Mm-hmm. So that feels that kind of, and it's a life together. That's a whole other thing beyond your, whatever you think your career means, which it means a lot, but I mean, having someone in your life is a really nice thing. We've been married 32 years now. Mm-hmm. Right, Bernadette? 32. We've known each other 34. So, after that, I started working on my own and as a songwriter and thinking about what I could, well, I was just kept writing, and I met up with Alex Call, who grew up here in town. And he was in that band Clover, which mm-hmm. played with Huey Lewis. And he and I hit it off just chemistry-wise, and we started writing a bunch of songs together. And I could play you one right now. This is the one that I had the song, the title called Circle of Friends. Mm-hmm. And he's a very inspired songwriter. He's got his own records out, too. And and I got together on this. I had the music going, but he really had all the music in the title. But EK started giving the ideas for the lyrics. So we were thinking about how the kids, when you're kids and you meet your friends and some of your best friends when you're growing up, and that how, and the years go by, those friends, some of them that you stick with or stick with you, they're like there for life. Mm-hmm. And it's like a great feeling of what true friendship goes back to a long time. It doesn't necessarily end. It keeps going, you know. So maybe you're lucky if you have, like I still have some really good friends from growing up that I'll see back east when we do a tour or something, my brother and I. So, and this, I think it resonates with anybody that knows what friendship's about. Somewhere along the line, you got friends. Everyone's got some kind of friends. And if you don't, you're missing something. Forever, that's a fact. is our stroll of friends. Now we're the old gods left to us. We're the swallows to pull up the river at dusk.
Beautiful. Very beautiful.
So that started my own solo career, really. That song and this one that I wrote, this one I actually wrote before Circle of Friends, but my brother Peter and I and Chris, we've all written together on and off. We weren't in the same group at the time playing together as the Rowan Brothers particularly, although we always get together once or twice a year. But I was writing a song about our dad. This is a flashback growing up. And Peter and I had always, we'd start a song that our Aunt Barbie used to say. We'd go, how do you remember our dad? Because, you know, he died in 1970 when we were pretty, I was pretty young, and 17. And she goes, oh, your father was a dreamer. And we go, daddy was a dreamer. Daddy was a dreamer. So we'd sit around and go, daddy was a dreamer. And we had to write a song about that. So we never quite got to it. But I started writing a song, and I started thinking, I came up with the first verse. It was, daddy was a dreamer. How he loved to sing and dance. The life of the party. Anytime you get the chance. Working days in the textile mills. Selling. Talking about the great big things he was gonna do instead. And me and my brothers raising hell just like he'd done. I guess we inherited daddy's grief for having too much fun. Said, boys, I can't blame you. Heaven knows I can't tame you. But don't ever be ashamed to say you are your father's son. Well, I had everything up except for, you'll never be ashamed to say, and Peter, wait. You are your father's son. I went, oh my God, that's the title, duh. So that's cool. That's a great thing about writing with your brother. Like, he just went, oh, you're your father's son. Like, oh my God, because I had everything, didn't have that line. I had daddy was a dreamer that he and I thought together. So we wrote that together and then we filled it in with, till the last chorus goes, but daddy, I can't blame you. And I know I can't tame you. But I'll never be ashamed to say. Thing was, see, daddy had kind of like the death of a salesman. Mm-hmm. He had a really tough business time, and I don't know if it added to his demise, but you know, we seem to be so much more. I think when I speak we, I mean, if we were lucky enough to growing up the way we had in California, especially too, the innovation of cuisine and getting back to the earth was so cool, and growing vegetables. So we were always into the health food and stuff. I mean, I guess I was in the East Coast too. I remember getting turned on to the concept of eating really well, you know, brown rice and, you know, going miso soup and stuff. And out here, it was really, I remember we did eat well. I mean, but trying, you know, avocados. We never saw those back east that, the heck's an avocado? We were like, oh my God, these are fantastic. But, you know, fruit and the produce out here is always so, all the, you know, I have the cold winters, right? So that was always a thrill about living in Marin. It still is. I mean, you want to have a great, just get out and go walk the mountain. So my wife and I have walked up Mount Tam from here 6 hours for a day if we really want to do it, right? Start here and you walk all the way down West Blytheville, go up the way up the Wheeler's Trail. I mean, this, and you're up at the top, take a picnic with you. Whew, it's like.
How has Mount Tam influenced your music? Has it?
Spiritual vibration of, I still go up there, my wife and I, Bernadette, go up there and sit on a couple of those, on the ridge there, would overlook Stinson Beach,
mm-hmm.
especially when it gets, the warm weather hits in June, it gets hot, sometimes the mountain will have that thermal thing going,
yes.
and it's like, I love the heat.
Mm-hmm.
Anything about Northern California, give me the heat more often. When those heat waves come in, like we get them, oh, I just love that. They come in these blasts. And of course, the dreaded fog. I hate the fog. Although I like it at times, but a lot of times it really, it shifts. So it's not, you know, Mill Valley will be fine, but if you go to Sausalito, it'll be, or it'll be cloudy at the beach. I remember living in Stinson Beach, maybe 14 days in a row one year. It was like, I gotta get out of here. It's like fogged and cold and it's summertime. But you go on top of the mountain above the clouds, it's 90 degrees up on the mountain. They close it off. No, the mountain was always, it still is, it's a refuge for inspiration. I mean, everything I write, I always relate to rivers. Rivers are like love. Mountains are like places you're trying to achieve. The metaphorical things you get from nature is so important. And it's just filled, it's all up there in Mount Tam. That's a great place to take a hike up there. There's so many hikes, and you just, an amazing place to ponder the universe.
You sang that beautiful song about the circle of friends, and you've been here for a good long while now, since 1970. And you obviously have a community of musical friends and other people that you've been collaborating with and sharing your life with. And do you feel like, how do you see yourself in Mill Valley? I mean, what has Mill Valley and this area given to you as not just a musician, but for your life?
Oh boy, an incredible lifestyle of peaceful place to live. Besides, I mean, I hate, there's a part of Mill Valley called Me Valley now. And I know I'm talking about that because I've lived here now 25 years in Mill Valley. Oh no, even longer, probably 32 years in Mill Valley. I lived at the old grocery store.
Where Whole Foods is now?
The deer. They come here all the time.
Oh.
He's no doubt quite. Okay. He's over in the neighbors. But
you see,
this is a nature preserve, really.
You have beautiful property here at your house.
Isn't it sweet? I mean, yeah. we lived at the old grocery store in Homestead Valley.
Uh-huh.
On a compound there. My wife, Bernadette's, one of her older past boyfriend, he kind of managed this property. This is an old, beautiful. It eventually got sold, but boy, it was.
Where is it?
There was a cottage. It's on Homestead Valley.
Uh-huh.
Right when you go up from the 2 a.m. club, mm-hmm. that little stretch, there's mm-hmm. that whole. But right on Linden Lane,
mm-hmm.
it's a little stretch. Opposite now of these, I think, retirement kind of low income.
Yeah, low income.
But they've been there for 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were probably one of the first ones that those developed. But we had this fantastic yard that was fenced in, and a beautiful property. A French couple bought it. Rightfully so, and they kind of preserve the whole thing. Don't really know them, but we'll drive by and say, just look at the place, and oh, they kept the whole outside. I don't know what they did inside, but it was an old grocery store. Our buddy at the time lived in that part, and we lived in the other half of the house, fire pit outside. But why was I saying? Oh, it was such a great, that sort of indoor outdoor thing you get here, and that's what I love about Mill Valley too. I mean, we walk every day.
But
what has it given me? It's a place of peace and peace, tranquility, really. A refuge when you stay here. I've written a lot, tons of music that gets recorded right in my home studio that's gotten me from that, my father's son. It's been an artistic inspiration. My studio's upstairs. I mean, I'm lucky to have that.
If you think about what it is you contribute, because it's nice to live in a place that feeds you, but what do you give back?
I hope that I bring some joy and laughter to and positiveness to through what I like to do, which is make music and perform music. I'm certainly open to helping out things that need support,
like the Gary Yost in the West Peak.
Oh yeah, well yeah. I think what I've found, well, through Gary, I've discovered another person that is really inspired by Mount Tam in particular. But he's very aware of creativity and in other people. And that's how we met. you know, he called me after we met at the O'Hanlon through really good friends, Daniel, Patrick, and Irma, who were great endorsers of promoting musical events and stuff to bring community together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I met Gary there about a year ago, and he followed up with me about a project. I guess creative people will pick up on each other to a degree. Anyway, we had a chemistry together, and he asked me if I could help him work on the pretend. First, it was the proposal for a permanent farmer's market there up in Zarefell. And I think that's, they need another couple of million. But he did this whole video about it, and he needed music, and he had, I guess somebody was, had hired him to do it, and he hired me, and he said, would you be able to come up with, so I shared him a bunch of stuff I had, and he went, oh, this is great, and so that worked out really cool, and from that he said, you know, I have something I need help on. I'm doing this thing about Montaigne, the last of his trilogy, or his four piece. I need someone to record the cello and guitar. I said, well, Jimmy Dillon's, I said, Jimmy, yeah, we're best friends. And he goes, oh, okay, great. So I said, yeah, come over here. So I recorded them easily in my studio. I can't do a whole band up there. I have a digital band, but not, you know, drum stuff. But yeah, cello and guitar. So I did that, and he said, you know, if you could do that, I'll give you some free time if you want to do a video. I said, I do. I have this band, which is my current band, Deep Blue Jam, which is Americana. I play a lot of mandolin. That's my current now thing that I'm doing. Tonight we're playing on KPFA live radio, 10 o'clock.
Who's in the band?
Okay, two guys that have been in the Edge band in this different incarnation than the original, but eventually became, so I'm talking 25 years now, I've been playing with Eric McCann on bass, and Matt Willis on drums, and a really great friend I met through doing a Marin County Visitor Bureau video they made, promotion video to bring people to come to Marin, to visit Marin. And I got invited by one of the gals there, and she said, you know, you'd be perfect in this. We're doing a couple. They come to Marin, and we want to do a video, a little short thing that we say hit all these highlights of Mill Valley and Marin. Mill Valley, the Sweetwater, San Rafael restaurants, artworks. So they made, if you go to the Visitor Bureau, I think they still have it there. But it's so I had my date, which was not my wife at the time. And not my wife at the time. No, she was not my wife ever. But she and I were like acting as a couple. Mm-hmm. And it was a blast. So Kirk Casey did the music for this thing. And I met him when they finally had the thing done. And we were like, oh, well, I do TV stuff too. And we always said, I love your song. He did this cool little jingle, you know, music, kind of quirky little thing. He said before he had this more sophisticated thing. And they said, well, can you give us something more quirky? So anyway, he and I hit it off, and we started doing some TV stuff as a starter. And then he said, why don't we do something around your mandolin and your voice? You know, so we've been working together 3 years or so, going on four. And we said, let's do a band out of this. And so we started a two-man band, really. And we recorded a lot of stuff. And then we added my guys from the Edge band,
mm-hmm.
Jimmy, Eric McCann and Matt Willis. Eric's played with Clarence Clemens' band. Jimmy had played in Clarence Clemens' band too, and Eric was the bass player in that. And Eric goes out, he plays with everybody.
I saw him at the Arts Festival Gala. He played with the band that was.
Yeah. So, you know, quite a few.
So this is.
Everybody knows everybody on that level.
Do you think of this being a circle of friends of musicians here in Mill Valley?
Yeah.
I mean, do you see yourself?
Yeah, there's a camaraderie and. I've called some people I don't know that well and said, can I get you for a session? And they'll, yeah, don't tell. I'll give you the brother deal. Or, you know, I mean, just because if you've known a lot of people, and I'm not saying it, I'm just saying it's nice that you can call some friends like that and that you don't even know that well, and they'll, you know, you're making a demo, you know? Yeah, everybody wants to get, you know, we all live by, you know, you make a living, you know, so. Mm-hmm. It's nice. There's a friendship on that. And some stuff is just gratuitously, you know, shared. Or, you know, if there's an event, I'm all for that. You know, if there's a revolution coming, let's go. And if it's, if it's about the election and stuff, I hear there's one in San Rafael. I might have to check that out.
when you think about going back in your life and starting so young, by the way, as a musician, your mother must have had a lot of trust in the universe to let those three boys go out into a wild world.
Well, once we got signed to, and she had to sign for me, my record deal with Columbia Records, because I was only 19 when I got signed by Clive Davis. We flew to New York to do that, and she had to fly down. Oh, that was, she was like, oh. Then she would take the record and she'd play it and record herself, because our Uncle George had given her this fantastic two-track recording, like something you didn't get back then. I think it was cassette. It was us cassette, you know, with a microphone. It was like he had all the new stuff, and he gave it to my mother, and my mother would play the record and sing along and send us these, and I have these saved on disc. I copied everything. I'm quite the keeper of the flame.
Yeah,
I have everything. My wife said, we got to clean out that closet.
Well, yes, if you ever need to, I suppose there's a musical, there should be some kind of musical museum here with so much music. And
yeah, well, I think they tried to start a rock and roll one.
Yeah.
Just didn't have enough, I don't know what. But yeah, it'll come around, I think.
But when you think back in your life, you know, there are going to be young people that are going to listen to this interview. And when you think about lessons learned or what matters most to you, what are those, what would be those thoughts?
I'd say be smart about what you're doing, and don't, be smart and try to find, look for the people that you can trust and that genuinely might have an interest in what you do that maybe can help you. I'm talking about the music business. I know there's young guys out there doing it all the time. You have to be persistent, and you gotta really want to love to do it, and you can't expect it to happen overnight. And if it doesn't happen, does that, you just keep going for what you really love to do? I mean, if I couldn't have made music, found different irons in the fire to keep going, I mean, some ways that's like, well, you're all over the map. Well, yeah, but that's, I guess I can do that. It's like a split personality, multiple personality, or multiple, you know, can you just do one thing really great? Maybe that's the way to do it. For me, it's turned out I needed to have different things to survive in the music world. But I push myself too, you know. I mean, I look for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not afraid to hustle, and I think that you have to do that. You have to kind of you got to be on it. You got to stay on it and just keep knocking on down doors and showing people what you got.
Any regrets?
Regrets. I wish I'd been a little smarter when I was younger. Yeah, I think smarter. Not a regret, but like, yeah. If you look at it, what is a regret? Something you regret. I wish I'd had a little more sense of what really should be going down. I guess being caught up in a whirlwind of with a bunch of other people that makes a group, and you're doing it all for one and for all. We came from nothing and we built into this thing. You gotta have a love there, friendship. And that's really tough when that falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't work out the way you thought.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of a big eye-opener of like, oh, geez, too bad. We had so much faith in it, you know? So you have to have a thick skin, too, to keep going from that. And we were young enough to be able to do that. And I don't know. The years have gone by.
Are you still close to your brothers?
Yeah, very close. Yeah.
Are they living
Chris
here?
And I play a lot together as a duo.
They both live here?
Yeah. Chris lives in Cotati at the moment, but we've all lived here together for years. Mm-hmm. Peter lives in Tam Junction now.
Mm-hmm.
So Peter's on his own trip. Chris does his own thing too, and I do my own thing, but he and I do play a lot. At least once or twice a month we're playing. And we toured back east and stuff. We keep our brother duet going a lot. And we got signed by an independent label about 10 years ago, and they wanted to put out a record, so we called it Now and Then, and the now is all new stuff, and the old stuff is like archived stuff that never was released, or might have been released, but different versions of it. So that's gave us a new life, really.
How about if you think of a moment during all this time since you've come here in your career as a musician and just in your life as a musical person, a creative person, is there any moment that stands apart? Nothing special, maybe something special, but just captures the essence of what drives you, what inspires you, a time, and if anything.
I think meeting my wife. was one of the biggest inspirations. It was like finding somebody that I really wanted to, that I actually told her, I said, when we get married. And she was like, what? No, she was like meeting somebody that you just felt, there was such a newness, but also a familiarity of like personality or something that you can't really put your finger on. And we have so much fun together. Of course, it's ups and downs, of course, but you know, they're definitely ups and downs. But we've been married to 32 years and we got a good thing going. It's like we've got to a place where we can really do a lot. We have a lot of freedom, you know. So that's a magical thing. And I know my friends that were in my bands when I was growing up. When they always said, "You are lucky." They always would say to me, "I want what you have," because I found that, you know, rock and roll, you know, yeah, a lot of chicks and a lot of
yeah. Women. What about that?
Yeah, but there's that element to it, but. When I found my wife, it was sort of like, oh, I don't want that other thing. I want this. And that's what you really want, is somebody you can really get close to.
Have you ever written her a song?
Oh, God, yeah.
On you the mandolin? I want to hear on the mandolin, too.
Oh, I'll do that.
We took a little break there, and now we're back, and you're going to sing a song?
Well, here's the thing. You asked me about, have I written a song about my wife? Since I've been married to her, every song that's a love song is about my wife. She always asks me, too, is that about me? Now, that there's one that's kind of angry, or she always, is that about me? Some songs are not always, as a writer, you may be writing from thinking about somebody else's point of view. So it's not fair, really, to blame the songwriter that like every song is about your wife, but there is a lot of good love that comes from it. And here's there's a couple I can just give you little snippets of. This one, she don't play up to anyone, raised as honest as they come, never hesitates to speak her mind. She won't be anybody's fool. That line, when you think you've learned a thing or two, she'll go changing all the rules. That's the way it's been since time began. That's the way a woman loves a man. So she always likes that one. And then I've got one that goes, love is a river flowing free, carries you and it carries me, keeps us afloat when the tides get rough. Takes just a little and that's more than enough. Help the wind come up, fill our empty sails, set us back on course after all else fails. Love brings me back to you when we drift apart, knows the ins and outs on the pathway. Love brings me back to you. And then one more example. This is really...
I like that you want to show the examples of the songs for your wife.
Yeah, there's two more. I'm going to just with little snippets of them. Twilight sky above turns midnight blue. Nowhere else I'd rather be than here with you. Heaven in your smile, heaven in your eyes. Every kiss and warm embrace is paradise. 'Cause you're the only one for me. So then there and then you got this one, which is what I always like to say, you know, when the going gets tough, my wife, she goes shopping. I can't stop in shopping feet, moving up and down the street. She is special, she is sweet, where there ain't nobody can compete with my babe. Flat. She keeps me waiting, anticipating. She is special, she is sweet. There ain't nobody can compete. So, you know, it goes on and on.
She really is your inspiration.
So that's the fun stuff.
Well, before we close up, you've played a lot of guitar, but I'm going to ask you as a personal favor if you can play a little something on the mandolin.
The mandolin, this is one of my favorite instruments. I started playing when I was 12 years old. And I play bluegrass, which was a...
David Grisman is bluegrass.
Yeah, I learned that run right there from David Grisman. As I was being produced by him, we shared a lot of musical stuff together. So that was... He showed me a few licks, and it took me even further into the mandolin, which I play today with my band Deep Blue Jam. So when I was a kid, though... I wrote this piece after listening to it when I was almost signed to Elektra Records when I was 15. They had this other company called Nonesuch Records, which is all this world music. And I'm at the office there in New York City, and the president said, "Why don't you go in and pick out some records?" I went, "Oh, great." I picked up a dozen records. I got music from Burundi, some harp music, found some lute music. But all kinds of cool indigenous music that you just, this was a great, and I just, we'd go home and play it. It was like, I was in another country. So I listened to lute music, and I somehow picked up a mandolin and transferred some ideas that I was hearing into a piece that I wrote. I call it Mandolina. play it every once in a while because it's like, it goes back like 50 years.
Wow. Obviously the music's in you, man.
Quite fun.
Now, before we go, I'm going to ask you one question I usually ask people. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to mention before we close?
I think my wife and I have lived here now 25 years, and we just almost have it paid off. So that part of it is like, wow. I mean, we are older, but I guess the getting older is kind of like, oh, geez, you see the years ticking away. But when you get to the point, you've lived in a place long enough and you always have it paid off, it's like, wow, that's fantastic. We really think of our home here in Mill Valley as a gold mine of what an opportunity that we won't have. We think about maybe we would keep this always and maybe go rent this out and rent some other place if we want to check something out. But we definitely wouldn't just sell this place and move out. Just on a whim, we're really like, oh boy, let's stay. We always love the location. And as the world gets smaller, God, you can't be closer to the airports, either one, Oakland or San Francisco. You're in the city, you're so close. Bike riding around here is incredible. Hiking. We love to go to the city, love to visit. If I visit somebody who lives there, it's like, wow, what a cool place. I never lived in the city. Just got spoiled by living in Marin County. I always had a chance to live out here. And just once you're be lucky enough to be able to buy property, you're not going to just jump up and go. But I've definitely been more of a country guy, living style, lifestyle. And I've been able to just do that. I guess that's where I have never had to live in the city, though I love it. I love museums and I love the accessibility to it. That's something that's great about Mill Valley.
Do you love the Mill Valley?
Oh, yeah. It's a unique place. And I love the mountain in town. It's like Switzerland. I like a mini Switzerland. No snow. Once in a while, there's snow. But I do. I believe in the spirituality of nature. I think that's part of what is it's kind of its own religion. Is nature is a religion in itself. Mm-hmm. Well, where are you from? So it's kind of nice. It's universal.
Well, that's a good note to end on.
Yeah, I think anything that the local things that happen I like to help be part of anything that goes on in Mill Valley. I know there's music things in the park and the fall festival, art festival.
Yeah.
And sometimes the Redwoods people, if there's something to do there. I used to go to my aunt back east because I have a family member that's living in an assisted living and it's a tough thing to do. You go and play for people, but it brings a lot of joy to people if you can share it on that level, besides just doing it as your career in front of a young audience, or your peers,
Mm-hmm. So, well, it seems like...
Bread and Roses is a good example of a nice thing that started by Mimi Farina in Mill Valley. Been able to help on that sometimes, which is nice. Glad to be able to do that.
I admire and appreciate that this river of music runs through you. Is something that you can share with everyone and our town.
Yeah, God.
And I thank you so much. I'm sure there's so many people that are going to listen to this that you are part of their history here. How music punctuates moments and that music will take you right back to that time.
Mm, that's nice.
So I think you're probably in the collective memory of many people that live here.
That's nice.
And I thank you for that. And I thank you for all the wonderful music and the good things you do. And on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library, I now thank you for sharing your story with us.
Pleasure.
For others to hear.
Pleasure.
And I guess we'll see you around town.
See you around town.